Conversations on Healthcare covered all of the big issues in 2024, from the White House to the Metropolitan Opera House. We examined how America designs, delivers, and pays for healthcare during the past 12 months.
As President Trump, a new Congress, and other new leaders in the states prepare for office, we offer this recap and we look ahead to the policies, the innovations, and the insights driving healthcare. This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. We hope you're resting up during the holidays because 2025 promises to get off to a fast start, Margaret, with intense confirmation hearings for President Trump's appointees to the top healthcare positions in the federal government.
That's right. But let's look back on how we got here. This was a year a lot of people wish they had a crystal ball. We often asked our guests what would happen if President Donald Trump was reelected. In late June, we heard the predictions from Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for KFF Health News. Let's hear it.
There is this Project 2025 that's been put together by, well, it's been spearheaded by the Heritage Foundation, but a lot of other groups have contributed to it. And it's basically a Republican wish list of everything they would like to do on health. I mean, on every issue, but there's a big section on health and work requirements for Medicaid and I think block granting Medicaid and turning Medicare into, you know, even more privatized than it is now. If Trump was elected, he would actually do those things. It's hard to know. I mean, the other part of Project 2025 is that they are vetting people who would like to come into the administration and do some of these things. So there's a probably better than 50-50 chance on a lot of these things, but that's certainly something that we would be looking at. Trump himself, obviously, when he was president, did talk a lot about drug prices. It's something he feels strongly about. He did talk about preserving Medicare and Social Security. Basically, I think he knew what a hot button issue it was and didn't want to get into it. We'll see if that would still be the same as we get. At some point, Congress has to do something about Social Security and Medicare if we would like them to still be there.
Right.
So you can't duck them forever.
Just before the election, we talked to Sarah Overmall, Washington correspondent for STAT, about a possible Trump victory. Specifically, we discussed the Make America Healthy Again focus of the Republican campaign.
Make America Healthy Again, obvious parallels to Make America Great Again, intentional. Robert F. Kennedy is one of the main people behind this, and he has been closely associated with Trump, especially since he dropped out of the race himself. He's on Trump's transition team. Even this weekend, Trump was saying that he is committed to putting Kennedy in his administration somehow. There's many arms to the Make America Healthy Again movement. A lot of it has to do with food policy, chronic illness, how to better manage chronic illnesses, but also a lot of it has to do with this idea that public health agencies are not always incentivized to make the right decisions for people because of pharmaceutical industry influence. And that's the part that has a lot of people nervous because, you know, there's Robert F. Kennedy himself has had anti-vaccine commentary in the past, and he's said in more recent months that that's not how he feels, but the record is there. And the way that he's discussing the pharmaceutical industry and the review that agencies like the Food and Drug Administration have of these drugs, we already have a confidence issue in the United States towards vaccines, towards treatments. And so it has a lot of people nervous about what he would do and who he would pick to be the people who oversee these very agencies. So I think it's a discussion that we're still going to see happen over the next few weeks. Trump has absolutely doubled down on Kennedy having some sort of role. But I'll note that he said that his first time that he got elected and Kennedy was not there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can have a little bit of a reality check here. And certainly, of course, Kennedy, if he was to be put up for any position like HHS secretary, that's a Senate confirmed position. So we don't think that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But could he be in the White House? Could he have a lot of influence? Absolutely.
Well, no disrespect to Sarah, but in this instance, her crystal ball was off. President Trump has indeed nominated Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. His confirmation hearing will be a big story in the coming weeks, as opponents are sure to seek to block his appointment.
Well, Margaret, it's one of many big stories that will be out there during the confirmation season. There was a feeling throughout the year that the healthcare issues, including abortion, would be very important to voters. Joyce Frieden oversees MedPage's Today coverage of Washington and the health policy and filled us in when we talked to her this spring.
We've seen in states where abortion has been on the ballot, it's really played out. People have turned out to vote, and it's been a lot in the Democrats' favor. So I'm sure the Republicans are watching that and figuring out how they can spin the issue. And there are just so many other abortion, healthcare-related issues on the ballot. There's on the ballot, but healthcare generally, I think, is on people's minds. Access to healthcare and the high price of prescription drugs, which the Biden administration has taken some actions on. So I don't know it'll be the top thing on everybody's mind, but I think it'll be there.
Of course, at the end of the day, the election was a clash of ideas and approaches. We heard from each side about how they view healthcare. First, Andrea Dukes, the vice president of health policy at the Center for American Progress, explained the problems that she saw with the Trump-Vance approach.
It's a pretty disastrous health policy. Like much of what you see in the Trump-Vance agenda, it is a hearkening to the past, going back to systems that don't work or that service just a small number of Americans. I think many voters forget what the world was like before the Affordable Care Act. It's sort of amazing how much that bill reshaped the entire American healthcare system, right? Just completely fundamentally changed what people expect from the healthcare system. But all we need to do is look, it's not even that old, right? It's 14 years old. But all we need to do is look pre-2010 to get a glimpse at how ineffective a tool like a high-risk pool is. So how does insurance work? Everybody buys into a system, risk gets spread out, right? Premiums are kept relatively low so that when people need to use coverage, they get really sick, they get cancer, they get into an accident, right? There's enough money in the pool to pay for those kinds of services without effectively breaking that bank. The plan to separate chronically ill people into high risk pools completely upends the notion of insurance, right? Those folks would be in their own pool with very, very, very high healthcare expenses. States tried to do this before the ACA. They had a very, 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 very difficult time doing it. It's very expensive to finance those pools. They're very volatile. You can only, because their expenses don't just magically go away, you just move them into their own pool, right? You run out of the money that gets allocated toward those risk pools very quickly. And you can't finance them necessarily on premiums alone because, again, the expenses are so high, right? It would effectively be unaffordable unless you really heavily subsidize enrollment in such a risk pool. So what you would probably see, again, is what we saw in the past, right? Which is enrollment would be capped. There'd need to be really, really a fine-tooth comb that goes through to decide whether or not people even qualify because maybe they're too expensive. So I think it's just a throwback to the wild, wild west that we had for folks who didn't have job-based coverage, right, or public coverage pre-ACA. It's a plan that doesn't work. It's a plan that we as a nation, right, that signed into law, or we got to a place where we had a landmark health reform, the Affordable Care Act, to get us out of that past. So it would be great to not go back to it.
Margaret, we also heard a counterpoint, the free market perspective from Wayne Weingarten, the senior fellow and director of the Center for Medical Economics and Innovation at the Pacific Research Institute. He spoke about IVF coverage and then addressed the larger issue within the insurance industry.
Speaking for myself, not for PRI, the important issue is not to mandate it, so that we need some insurance absolutely are going to cover it because people demand it and people want that. But part of the problem that we're seeing with the ACA is that there are so many different mandates of different types of coverage that it's harder and harder for people to get the insurance that's appropriate for them, let alone the fact that our insurance isn't actually providing that key insurance benefit that we need. right? If health insurance was doing what it was supposed to do, it wouldn't be covering first dollar payments of when you go to a checkup, and that's not a financial risk. What we really need is health insurance to be there for in vitro fertilization, right? When you actually have a costly medical procedure that's an actual risk, that's where insurance is supposed to come into play. That's what we're actually missing. But the best way to get that type of coverage is to reduce the mandates and allow insurance companies to be competing for enrollees by providing that best coverage. We don't have that. And that's the system we really want to start moving toward. And that's, but the problem with mandates is that it makes it that much harder for insurance companies to actually tailor plans to the way that people need it.
We learned about research in Lancet Child and Adolescent Health that found that children of color in America receive less treatment and fewer life-saving interventions than white children. Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris, pediatrician and researcher at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University, helped lead the project and make this clear to us.
Some of this is rooted in hundreds of centuries of racialized thinking and racialized medicine. Back in the days, and actually it wasn't that long ago, but when med students still believed and were taught that Black children, Black adults have thicker skin, so they don't feel pain in the same way, or they have stronger lungs, and so they can handle more, you know, infections and harder work. These are ideologies that were held in times of enslavement, right, to justify how Black people, especially children, were treated. If you believe they're not feeling as much pain, you can inflict more pain, more work, more burden. And those ideologies, those thoughts, those ideas continue to get passed on into medicine, so much so that you can look at studies from maybe even just 10 years ago where medical students said, yes, I think there's something different about Black skin versus white skin. So you don't need as much pain medicine. You don't need as much attention to pain because the pain is not there. Or we don't believe that people are in such pain. When we think about children that really deal with pain crises, so sickle cell, how those children and also those adults are seen as we called them drug seekers, right? Like they're not really in that much pain. They're just looking for drugs. They're just looking for pain medicine when really they don't need it. And it's that sort of teaching from medical students, and then they grow up to be, you know, attendings and residents and trainees, and that keeps it going. And so that's really our thought. This study didn't parse out like why these disparities exist within pain, but just that they exist. But we do know from years and decades of the studies about the beliefs that physicians hold specifically. But with that being said, it's unacceptable. You know, if a kid breaks their arm, if they have appendicitis, if they're having migraines, and in some cases, what we studied was having a digit replaced, so having a finger or toe replaced, you can imagine incredibly painful. So they need adequate pain medicine, no matter what race or ethnicity they are.
Absolutely. And you found that children of color face longer wait times for care at the emergency room. Maybe a couple of questions. How much longer of a wait time are we talking about? And I'm wondering, do you know if this is unconscious bias at play?
These are all, I mean, you guys are asking the questions that we need. The next study is the next steps to try to figure out what is happening here. Just in my other work, I know that there are extensive structural barriers to care for many marginalized groups and many racialized groups, meaning, you know, they might have to access care that's further away. They don't have as many physicians. Their insurance isn't taken everywhere at every different healthcare facility. And so that could be leading to overcrowding and longer wait times or delays in care. You don't go, you're like, oh, it's not that bad. Like, I don't want to wait 4 hours, 5 hours in the emergency room, or you have waited for 4 or 5 hours in the emergency room and you've got your second shift job. You can't continue to wait. So we've also found that racial and ethnic minority families are more likely to leave without being seen at all in the emergency room. So they did seek care, they tried, and then for whatever reason had to leave. But to your question and to your point, we need to do more work to try to figure out what is that? What are the reasons for that? Is it, you know, accessibility to care? There's literally not enough places where they can get care, or there's not enough places that will accept insurance, or there's not enough providers. Like, what is the issue here?
Innovations with artificial intelligence was a big focus for us. No surprise, right? Everyone's talking about AI, including in mental health space. Dr. Jody Halpern is a psychiatrist, noted author, and co-founder of the University of California, Berkeley's Group for Ethics and Regulation of Innovative Technology. And really, she laid bare the problems that are arising from marketing of these AI services, especially to young people.
Oh, that gave us quite a bit to chew on as we were ending up the year.
So I said 61% of adolescents and young adults, we have that data now, suffer from extreme loneliness in the United States, 2/3. And the only country with data like that is South Korea. What does the US and South Korea have in common? Our children spend 8 to 10 hours a day on online social activities. This is in addition to doing their homework online. So they basically are either gaming or on social media, as far as I can tell, every minute they're awake. I mean, unless they're really not sleeping. So
also a problem.
Well, no, it's related. It's extremely related, because a lot of my work has been showing how as a psychiatrist who's also studied neuroscience, the mechanisms that social media for-profit companies, all the large companies, which any two of which have more money, and the seven largest companies, media companies, digital companies, mm-hmm. Google, Meta, et cetera, any two of them have equivalent money to the whole federal government. Mm-hmm. So their power to determine and keep us from having regulation is very, very large. So we're the most unregulated country compared to Europe and some of the Asian countries that have anything like our scope. And one of the things that the UK did years ago was regulate marketing to children for social media and gaming and the technology that gets kids addicted, which is irregular rewards. It's the same thing that gets us addicted. In fact, Instagram uses it, which most people don't know. Instagram doesn't, every time you put up something, a picture, it doesn't just give you back your likes. It saves them up in bundles and gives them to you irregularly, the way slot machines work in Las Vegas. And that technology, which we saw the patents for 10 years ago and started talking about then, that develops dopamine surges that get you addicted. So the fact that we're all addicted to our phones, addicted to social media, and addicted to gaming is not accidental. It's not accidental. It's the marketing model of those companies. And I am seeing the same marketing model in the relational support bots for children. And so that is what concerns me, because it's one thing to say we need to get mental health resources that use technology into the schools for kids. We do. We do need to help kids, and kids are comfortable with technology. So if we have ways of them connecting with real humans or other kids, or using some online technologies that I'll describe that don't make you addicted in the same way, mm-hmm. that would all be very useful. But we actually have a good series of reviews by business reviewers, including the Harvard Business School has a letter that's very in-depth from an engineering and business expert on how one of the most important mental health companies that has gone through the FDA and is held up as a role model, how their business model is giving the app free to kids in schools, the app that just has a bot. You never talk to a human, because it's, quote, a sticky technology, and therefore children will get used to going to a bot rather than a human for mental health, and they'll grow up to be adults who are used to only using bots. And so it's a very good business model for a company. So there's a for-profit motive in getting this, even from very professionally endorsed companies that are for-profit, if they are for-profit mm-hmm. in the mental health sphere.
Well, interest in AI has led the New England Journal of Medicine to appoint its first editor-in-chief to a publication devoted to the topic. Dr. Isaac Kahane serves in that role. He is a groundbreaking Harvard University professor. He spoke about the nascent technology and its potential for bias as well, of course, as for good.
You can actually run tests on these AI programs and say, oh, would you propose that diagnosis more often if this was an African-American or an Indian-American? And you can actually adjust these programs to reflect that of that bias so that they en masse are changing their behavior. But that raises a kind of opposite question, which is right now, yes, a lot of the biases come from the data, but I think that most people are less aware of how many more biases, most of them with good intent, come from what's called steering or alignment of these models. After these models are trained up, it turns out they will talk about pretty uninteresting things. And so one of the early understandings in the last 3-4 years was that use of reinforcement learning and the so-called instruct model to steer these models towards interesting conversations and to acceptable conversations was important. So, for example, you would not want a program to respond to a person with a detailed request for suicidal procedures or for lethal homicidal procedures. Right. And OpenAI and others have worked a lot on that steering.
Now, and when you say steering, this is really prompting of AI in terms of how we frame up our questions?
It's implemented, it's more than just prompting. Mm. What it does is it creates a sort of essentially a layer on top of these programs where it says, here are a bunch of prompts, here are the kind of answers we're expecting to right. those prompts. Right. And then there's an automation process whereby we start saying to it, give us right. prompts, and we'll just rate right. Your answers to those prompts. And in a somewhat amusing example of perhaps an overshoot, you know, Google famously in its early steering of Gemini was so concerned about representation that it overshot. And so when you asked it for pictures of Nazi soldiers, they were showing African-Americans or Africans, Nazi soldiers. And so that's being taken care of and it's no longer such a problem. But here's where, looking mm-hmm. forward, we have to ask what values right. are going to be inserted in. And you can imagine, when you see a doctor, most of the time, until they start talking about the yacht they want to buy, you assume that your interests as a patient are the ones that are being optimized for. Mm-hmm. But who are developing these models? Mm-hmm. Whose interest do they have the most? Could be public health, which is not always aligned with personal health. It could be the healthcare institutions, which is also not always aligned. And so those questions are, in my mind, more important than the bias questions.
Well, that's so impressive that the journal created that new edition. You know, we ended up with some uplifting themes at the end of the year. First, we spoke with Dr. Amit Sood, who is called the happiness doctor, which is kind of nice to have at the end of the year, and is the CEO of the Global Center for Resilience and Well-Being. He explained how to recognize stress and reprogram the brain to deal with it. Useful information as we close out this really intense year.
We've done over 3 dozen clinical trials that have consistently shown that changing how we look at our life and the becoming more self-aware and aware of others and small little changes in direction completely can change how we are experiencing life, how productive, happy, and connected we feel. So there's 3 steps to the program or the approach. The first step is to become aware of why we are stressed. And that really originates in how the human brain operates. Our brain is not designed for peace and happiness. It is designed for survival and safety. We have negativity bias. If you're lying on a bed of flowers, if there's one thorn sticking, you will feel that in your thigh. And that's what happens. You had a wonderful day, met 20 great people, but one person gave a negative comment. That is the person you're going to be thinking about as you're driving back home. So we have this negativity bias. Our mind tends to wander a lot. And by the way, our brain gets tired in 90 minutes. So by 10 a.m. in the morning, if you're not choosing to rest your brain, you're working with a tired brain, and tired brains don't know how to be happy. So that's the first part, awareness. We educate people about their brain. It's like you won't drive your car without knowing how the steering wheel operates. Then why would you live your life without knowing how the brain operates? The second part is attention. You know, what you focus on, it's like you're going to a restaurant and there's a menu of 200 items. Now, if you don't train your attention, you're going to tell the waiter, the server, please get me items that I'm allergic to and the ones that are icky and expensive and that will make me throw up tomorrow. That's the kind of thoughts I want to think. But with good attention, you focus on what is nurturing. So we help people train their attention to focus on, let's say, gratitude, on kindness, self-compassion, self-acceptance. And third part is mindset or attitude. So awareness, attention, attitude. When stuff happens, like let's say you're driving to the airport and you got pulled over and you got a ticket. Now, how long are you going to keep that cop in your head? You know, 2 minutes, 2 hours, 2 days? So the goal is to recover quickly because stuff happens and you don't want to torture yourself. So those are the three steps, and they can be learned relatively quickly, relatively easily. And I find people are hungry for this kind of authentic stuff that has been scientifically validated.
Well, you've had a number of very interesting experiences in your lifetime, including meditating with a Himalayan monk and meeting with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. But I'm wondering what you say to those who believe psychotropic medications are best for them, or should we say a glass of wine at dinner? Some may think reprogramming their mind is not right or it's too tough. What do you have to say about that?
I will not disagree with them. I try not to disagree with, because everybody has a point and opinion, and there is some logic to it. Now, people who are really, really struggling in the trenches, like if you have a fractured bone, then your bone needs help for it to heal. Similarly, some people who have got a significant genetic predisposition, who were never hugged in child as a child, who were abused as a child, and have got a lot of stress, and that's how they have mental breakdown. They need help with psychotropic medications. They need help with therapy and with other things. But I think for a majority of us, I think if we can align our thinking with our core values, that will be helpful. It's like what I'm not saying is, for example, there's, you know, I live in Minnesota. There's a lot of snow in the driveway. And when I shovel the snow, when the driveway is full, I can't drive my car, it gets stuck. When I shovel the snow to the side, I'm not melting the snow, but it opens the driveway. Similarly, when I have negative thoughts and I have self-doubt and imposterism and all of that, then it'll clog my mind. It will prevent me from completely blossoming and from being able to help others and from being authentically happy. So I shovel those thoughts to the side. That's all what we are doing. We're not, you know, brainwashing, negating the mind. We're choosing to live by our values. And I think it's a healthy combination of both. We need both. We need the right chemicals in our system. And we also need the right way to think. And when you combine both, sky's the limit. We see, the challenge is, and this really bothers me, that we work so hard, humans do. We're so wonderful. Nobody can forgive like we do. Nobody has the, we donate $1 trillion in charity. We give our kidneys to strangers. Yet we suffer the most emotionally. You've never heard of sharks having panic attacks or lions walking around with chronic anxiety. But humans, you know, experience fear every single day. And we don't need to do that. A lot of stress is optional. And I think if we can work through some of the ways we are thinking and focus on common purpose of helping build a better world, we'll be much better off.
It was an intense year. We were also honored to be joined by opera superstar Renee Fleming, a real treat, I think, in the course of this year, who served as the editor of a new book this year. It was titled Music and Mind. And Renee explained how she took part in National Institute of Health study that relied on a functional MRI to uncover the effect of music on the brain. I think on her brain in particular.
That's right.
Very fascinating.
Well, it was really extraordinary. It was, I spent 2 hours in the fMRI machine. So this is a functional MRI that is measuring blood oxygen in the brain. And the activity included speaking, singing, and imagining singing. And imagining singing in my experiment was the most impactful part of the experiment. So it activated more parts of my brain than the other two activities. And the scientists were perplexed by this because they assumed that singing would be the most powerful activity. But what they ultimately surmised is that because I'm a singer, singing is second nature, whereas imagining singing took a little bit more effort to tune out the noise of the fMRI machine and to stay focused on the audiation. So I was audiating the actual music at the same time. But it was fascinating to see what it looks like in the brain and how many different parts, all parts of the known mapped brain show signs of experiences with music.
Well, that is quite fascinating. But I also thought was fascinating is that Dr. Francis Collins, former director of NIH, wrote the introduction to the book. What a wonderful introduction. We know him. We've had him on our show before. We would have loved to have been in that small gathering of you all singing together with the Supreme Court Justice. Tell us about the connection back to NIH.
So I met him rather randomly at a dinner party when I first was coming to D.C. on a regular basis. And it was a wonderful dinner party because we were with the justices literally the day after the marriage equality decision. So they were, I would say there was a little tension between them. This was such a fraught decision. And we know how close Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were. They were close friends. But and I was seated between them because they're both opera lovers. But it took a while for people to relax and warm up a little bit. It was a great, great evening. And Francis Collins, now I know this to be normal for him, brought his guitar. And we joined with the trio that was performing and had kind of a sing-along with everybody. And one of the most, I would say symbolic songs was The Times They Are Changing. Mm. And I asked him that night, why are scientists studying music? I at that time couldn't understand why they might be looking at music in the brain. And he said, because we have a new brain institute and we want to understand more about the brain. And we've discovered that music in particular is so impactful. So, and I said, well, I just started at the Kennedy Center as an advisor. What do you think about us providing a platform for science at the Kennedy Center? Because I think audiences would be fascinated to know what's happening when we're experiencing great art. And so this has been and become a tremendous passion for me to share this work with the public and really to be an advocate for the field of arts and health.
Renee has such a wonderful voice. And on that note, it seems like the right time to wish everyone happy holidays and the best wishes for a terrific 2025.
And just a reminder, to be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X with our account, CHC. As always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please, we welcome you sharing your thoughts and comments about this program. Happy holidays. Happy New Year to everybody. We'll see you in the new year.
Absolutely.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.